It is Tuesday, March 5th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
Ahead on Ozarks, the latest conversations about Medicaid's future in Arkansas. Roby Brock will talk with Bo Ryle, the president of the Arkansas Hospital Association, about the possible economic implications of Medicaid expansion. He'll also talk to John Burris, the chairman of the House Public Health Committee, about the legislative fate of Medicaid expansion. Plus, a pretty good deal this month at a local farmer's market.
First, Governor Mike Beebe yesterday issued his second veto of the session, and again, it was an abortion-related bill that was passed by the Arkansas House and Senate. Matt DeCampbell is a spokesman for Governor Beebe.
He vetoed the 12-week abortion ban for the same reason that he had vetoed the 20-week abortion ban, which is it appears to fly in the face of established court precedents and the Constitution. And he felt that the case law out there would render this bill unconstitutional and the potential cost to the state if, in fact, we are sued and we lose and have to pay the court costs for opposing counsel.
The legislature easily overrode last week's veto with a simple majority. The Senate is scheduled to consider an override of this bill's veto this afternoon. It would ban most abortions after 12 weeks, and it does make exceptions in cases of rape, incest, or the life of the mother. If it does become law, it would be one of the most stringent abortion laws in the country.
State revenues are up in Arkansas for the month of February, but finance officials say it's because income tax refunds have not gone out yet. The Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration yesterday said the state's available revenues from income taxes for last month are nearly $16 million above forecast. For the same month, sales tax revenues are below forecast. Governor Mike Beebe says the sales tax numbers do concern him.
It's down, what, $8 or $10 million, I guess, so, compared to forecast. So income tax is making up for it because people are working. But it's something worth watching, yeah. It's another reason to be conservative.
Governor Beebe says with current revenue numbers, tax cuts may be hard to come by. DF&A says the state's net available revenues for February totaled $210 million.
A group that advocates for hospitals says an independent report shows expanding Medicaid in Arkansas would create thousands of new jobs. Bo Ryle, president of the Arkansas Hospital Association, says they commissioned the study from George Washington University.
We wanted to measure the amount of jobs and the rollover impact on the economy, and in 2014, that would mean 8,500 jobs and rising to almost 11,000 jobs.
Bo Ryle says that would spur economic growth, allowing for new tax revenue, which would offset the eventual expense to the state. The group is releasing the report as lawmakers consider whether to expand Medicaid under the federal health care law. State Representative John Burris, a Republican from Harrison, says news last week that funds could be used to buy private insurance makes an expansion more likely.
We finally got some flexibility from the federal government that we had been consistently asking for 6 months.
But he notes many within his party still have a lot of questions before they go along with an expansion. About a quarter of a million Arkansans would become eligible if an expansion is approved. We'll hear more from both Representative John Burris and Bo Ryle in a few minutes on Ozarks at Large.
Following Arkansas Speaker of the House Davy Carter's push to cut nearly $150 million in taxes during this legislative session, local State Senator Jim Hendren of Gravette says he has his own idea of where to start with the cuts.
The one that I want to start with is to remove the income tax on our military in Arkansas. They pay a 7% tax, and most of our surrounding states have already done this. And I think it's only fair that before we start doling out tax cuts for everyone else, we ought to start with the guys and the ladies and men who have stepped up and really paid the price the last 10 years. So I've got a lot of support. I've got 23 out of 35 Senate co-sponsors, and hopefully we'll get that bill passed here this week.
The cost of the tax cut for members of the military would cost the state $7.2 million, amounting to just under 5% of the total amount of proposed revenue cuts. Senator Hendren says that he proposes giving members of the military a tax cut before everyone else as a way of recognizing the service they have given to the state and country in the past decade. But he says giving back to the men and women in uniform is only one perk of his proposed tax cut.
It's also good for our economy. Right now what happens is all these kids that are serving, when they get stationed in Oklahoma or Texas or Florida or Tennessee or these states that have exempted income or don't have income tax, they change their residency, and then they're less likely to come back to Arkansas. They're less likely to buy cars and tag cars in Arkansas. when they're stationed here at Little Rock, you know, many of them aren't Arkansas residents because they would have to start paying our income tax if they became an Arkansas resident. So I think it'll offset some of that cost, but plus it's just the right thing to do.
The bill has been amended to include not only enlisted military personnel, but also National Guard and Reserve units as well. The bill will return to the Senate Committee on Revenue and Taxation tomorrow morning.
Northwest Arkansas is home to a handful of the world's billionaires. Forbes magazine yesterday released its richest people on the planet list, and five area residents made the list of 1,426 billionaires from around the globe. Four members of the Walton family made the list. Christy Walton, the widow of John Walton, ranked 11th on the list with a net worth of just more than $28 billion. Jim Alice and S. Robson Walton made the list at numbers 14, 16, and 17, respectively, all with net worth over $26 billion. Janelle Hunt, the widow of trucking magnate J.B. Hunt, was ranked at number 792 on the list with $1.9 billion in accumulated wealth.
The Rogers Historical Museum is in the process of drafting storylines for two new permanent exhibits to be housed in the museum's new facility, but the museum needs the public's help in gathering additional items for the exhibits not currently in the museum's collections. The exhibit titled Our Natural State will focus on the natural environment of the Northwest Arkansas region and how it has had an impact on history over time, while the White River exhibit will tell the story of Beaver Dam and its impact on the area. The museum is seeking Benton County photographs of ranching, lumbering, mining, caves, extreme weather, and sinkholes, as well as photos of everyday life and farming activities along the White River before Beaver Dam was built. In addition, the museum would like to acquire ranching items from Benton County, such as riding gear, branding irons, or livestock record books, as well as objects used by families who lived along the White River before it was dammed.
Mostly clear tonight with lows from the mid to upper 20s. Sunny tomorrow with highs from 47 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 53 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Expect partly cloudy conditions tomorrow night with lows from 23 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 31 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. As the Arkansas legislature continues to work in Little Rock, the fate of Medicaid in Arkansas remains unknown. Last week, Governor Mike Beebe told lawmakers the federal government has given the state the go-ahead to move some Medicaid money into a private insurance exchange. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently talked with the chair of the House Public Health Committee, John Burris, about Medicaid's future role in the state. We'll hear that conversation in a moment, but first, another. Roby sat down with Bo Ryle, the president of the Arkansas Hospital Association, to discuss the possible economic impact of expanded Medicaid. Roby first asked him about something that has been nicknamed the Woodwork Effect.
In the new healthcare law, if we do take advantage of Medicaid expansion, then more people, we're looking at 200,000 to 250,000 more people that would be insured. But there's people out there who are eligible for the current Medicaid program who, as you say, would come out of the woodwork and then be covered under Medicaid.
And how big is that population? Is there an estimate on how large that population
Our studies show that to be about 33,000 people.
All right. Why are they not in the system now if they qualify for the system already? What is it about the changes that brings them out?
Well, it certainly may be just not knowing that they're eligible, not knowing the rules of eligibility. It could be the stigma of Medicaid.
All right. Let's talk about what's going on in terms of what your study showed. Tell me, first of all, who produced the report for you, what you had asked them to do, and kind of what some of the highlights are.
Right. We worked with George Washington University and the Regional Economic Modeling Incorporated, REMI, in which I know that we wanted an independent analysis of, first, the Medicaid expansion and its impact on Arkansas, and number two, the numbers that Dr. Andy Allison had projected would the savings that would occur through Medicaid expansion. So I know we wanted an independent look at those, and we know that the state legislature has engaged REMI to look at the Mississippi County Steel
Super Project.
So we felt like it would be a good independent analysis. What we found was that the amount of money that's going to be coming into the state through Medicaid expansion, if it were to occur, $800 million a year. And it would increase to $1.3 billion over the years at its peak. We're talking about, in this study, that equates to 8,500 jobs up to 11,000 jobs. So It's certainly an economic impact, an economic driver, if we do accept those dollars.
These are things that happen within the healthcare industry, that $800 million, the up to over $1 billion that you're talking about, things that have an impact, a ripple effect through hospitals, medical clinics, nurses, the whole home health care system. That's what we're talking about, right?
That's what we're talking about. When those monies come in from the federal government and they're paid to providers, employ doctors, they employ nurses, they have staff, those people go out, they buy cars, they buy groceries, so it's a rollover effect in the economy.
Now, the study does not take into account maybe some of the negative aspects of that, what the economic impact of the federal law may be in terms of new taxes on businesses, for instance, or new regulations and some of the things that might shift some people into different areas. Is that's not in this study, is it not?
No, it's not. We had a narrow focus, and that was to look at the impact of these new dollars coming in and what kind of job creation it would be, job retention, and the new dollars coming into the state and the rollover effect in the economy.
So there could be some counterbalance there, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make.
Sure.
It could be. Let's talk about the Medicaid breakthrough that occurred this past week. On Tuesday, Governor Beebe shared with legislators the fact that the federal government has given the state permission to take Medicaid dollars for expansion and use it into the health insurance exchanges to basically move this population of Medicaid expansion into a private insurance kind of silo there. You like that move?
We do like that move. We thought it was a very positive move that Governor Beebe went and visited with Secretary Sebelius. He took Republican legislator ideas to Washington, got some flexibility, came back, presented those ideas, and we think it's a positive step, and we hope to see that this could lead to passage of Medicaid expansion in some form.
Roby Brock talked to Bo Ryle, the president of the Arkansas Hospital Association, last week. Roby also talked to John Burris, a Republican member of the House from Harrison and the chair of the House Public Health Committee. Roby asked him about last week's news regarding Medicaid in Arkansas.
In short, we finally got some flexibility from the federal government that we had been consistently asking for 6 months. Since the Supreme Court ruling, there was always a question of what options states would have. Health and Human Services on a federal level had always said none. To us, and I mean by us meaning Republican legislators in Arkansas, we're not comfortable with that. The debate has consistently been about an all or nothing approach, but we were calm and patient and asked for better options, and this week learned that maybe there's one out there, but in a lot of ways it just kind of, it gives a whole new framework to a policy discussion where we're starting from scratch.
Do you think that this is a more cost-effective way to deliver health care in the state of Arkansas, to go through the private exchanges versus the public dollars of Medicaid?
Well, I think it undoubtedly can provide better quality of care to consumers in a hopefully a less expensive way to the state government, because again, the only option previously was expanding Medicaid, which you know very well is facing shortfall year after year after year. The only option previously was expanding what I considered to be a broken program that was on a path to insolvency, and doing it in a way with very tight federal restrictions that probably guaranteed failure. This is completely different. It's a 180 from where we were. It is a conservative, market-based, consumer-friendly option. A lot of questions still to go, but it's definitely a start.
Well, let's ask some of those questions, because one of the things right now, you've got two kind of 800-pound gorillas in terms of the health insurance market in Arkansas, Blue Cross Blue Shield, QualChoice. Those are your two biggies.
Right.
Does this open up the markets, do you think, if this new population moves in, if this Medicaid money moves over into the health insurance exchanges with that Medicaid population, do we have more competition for health insurance in Arkansas?
I think we have to. You have to have carrier competition, because that guarantees the best prices and the best product for the consumer. I think it's possible now. You're adding a large pool, a very large pool, of what have been defined as typically young, working-age adults, a healthy population, low utilizers of the system. I think we have a great opportunity to offer more and diverse products on the market than we did before.
Some will argue that this path to going through private insurance exchanges is going to cost more money than it would just a straight up Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. How do you answer that criticism?
It's something we have to work through. I don't think anybody knows the definitive answer yet, but you know, Surgeon General Joe Thompson was in the paper today, and Director Selig, both stating that they thought that there was a greater economic impact through this approach and that maybe it would be less. I think even Surgeon General Thompson disputed some of the CBO numbers that had been used that people are quoting on whether or not this is more expensive or not. We haven't seen any Arkansas-specific numbers. Again, these are young, working-age adults, low utilizers of the system. I think there's a way to set some definable. So number one, I think that we need to get some Arkansas-specific numbers,
okay,
because this is an Arkansas-specific plan. But I also think there's a way to save state dollars by transitioning people out of our Medicaid system into a private plan. We need to set some definable targets for reductions in Medicaid enrollment, and also along with that, personnel and overhead. I think there's a way to reduce what we're doing on Medicaid now and the state's obligation to it and put people in a private plan where they get better coverage.
Do we revisit the fact that we shot down a state-run health exchange? We now have a state-federal partnership. There's been some talk about going to a full-blown federal health insurance exchange. Does that debate reopen?
It's
and what do you think's best?
Well, it's something we have to discuss. I mean, to me, it's very much down the path because we are on the path to a partnership. I don't know that can change. I'm probably comfortable staying on that path now. The issue with the federal exchange was always whether or not it would be sustainable. I'm sorry, the problem with the state exchange was whether or not it would be sustainable. The reason the federal exchange was always appealing was because the federal government was assuming the risk for the law that they implemented if it proved to be unsustainable, which in a couple of states it has. With the partnership, we have a little bit of protection if it does prove to be unsustainable, but a minimum amount of input. So I don't view it as directly a part of this debate. Eventually, it probably becomes an issue, but no different than it would, because the state can always look back and revisit whether or not it wants to take over full control.
Last question for you. Do you have a supermajority of votes to get this implemented? Do you think it's there now?
Well, we don't have a policy to have a vote on. I just want to stress completely that.
In theory, though, do you think that the mentality is there, the appetite's there for it?
I think that there was no appetite for Medicaid expansion, which is why we are here today. A supermajority, at least a majority of people, said no to expanding a broken government program, and that's why we're sitting here today having this discussion.
Ruby Brock talked to John Burris, the chairman of the House Public Health Committee in Little Rock. You can hear more from that conversation and the one with Bo Ryle at talkbusiness.net. Support for talkbusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at mitchellwilliamslaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com.
The NFL Combine just ended, a week of college football players trying to make the big time. There were grueling physical tests, long interviews with scouts and team managers. This year, Colorado's Nick Casa says he was asked if he likes girls. I'm Ari Shapiro, pro sports and sexual orientation. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 on KUAF.
Thursday night, the All Islam Students Association at the University of Arkansas is inviting everybody to a forum discussion about the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. Last month, 3 of the organizers of the local event came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Hamid Nassim, the advisor to the student organization, and 2 students, Khaled Al-Shaman and Sophia Nassim, the president of All Islam Students. Hamid Nassim says Thursday's event is part of a larger series of seminars.
This is a nationwide campaign of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. In the wake of 2 previous events that our community had done in the memorial event of the 9/11, where we raised blood for the local communities. And in the past 2 times when they did this, we raised over 11,000 pints of blood on each event. So it seems like it makes a bigger impact on the communities who have to do the work, as well as it will make bigger impact on the communities where we live individually. And so I think that this was the reason why our community picked to do it in a nationwide campaign. And this was in response to the vitriol that was thrown against the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi, peace be on him, through that movie that came in, The Innocence of Muslims, or something like that. So any time a big event like this one takes place, it may be in response to something that had already happened, or it may be just because we want to let the name of Prophet be spread throughout the nation.
This is a student organization. You're the faculty advisor. You have brought with you one of the students. Tell me some of the things that you've done to prepare and some of the things that the organization has done through the years.
We have a lot of things, actually, we did in the past. And for this event, especially, we have a lot of posters. We have a book. We going to spread out this book, and it's going to be free for anyone who want to know something about Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him. We invite one good speaker for this event. And we will start with a recitation of Quran, some verses which shows or talk about Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace upon him, and how is he is very nice and very he sent actually for the people to be as mercy for the whole people, not just for part of this world. Muhammad for all the people.
I went to the event last year, I believe, and saw the crowd. What, when you look out and you see the crowd that's attending, what do you hope to see? Because obviously members of, as you put it, your community, but this is open to all.
Yeah, actually, our intention is to bring a bigger cross-section of the community where we live in. Our own community members or Muslims in general would come to help, but main audience for us are the people who don't know about the Prophet. Or previously, we have done other events in which, for example, we did a Founders Day event where we would bring a Christian priest and a Jewish rabbi and a Muslim scholar who would sit on the same table, and then they will give their own rendition of what they understand as their religious leader stood for, and then they are there to answer questions from public. So the whole thing is to educate everybody about the commonality between religions. And if we know how closely knit we are, people would not even worry about small differences. And I think that we want to highlight that. And if we are successful in highlighting that we have so much in common, the difference is just like the color of the skin. Rest of all bodily functions, everything works the same way. So religion is like a person, and these are all different manifestations of it. In the Holy Quran, God says that we have created different languages and different colors so that people could understand. And Allah, God, provides this as a sign for humanity. So the same thing is true of all different religions. These are all feathers of different, you know, type in the same pheasant, you know, makes it look beautiful. Everything has its own place there. And I think that we want people to realize that.
What happens from 5:30, 7:30 on the March 7th is to begin ripples. You're not going to have a million people there. But if someone's there, learn something, and perhaps it comes up in conversation a few days later with other people, and that's...
That is exactly what... This is, you know, these events could only be like seeds. And seeds which have some moist earth around it. Not just seeds, like Jesus Christ said. There are some seeds which are scattered on dry land, and the bird will come and pick them up and then eat them. That's the end of it. Mm-hmm. But then there are those seeds which find their way into a good soil, and they will turn into a fruitful tree, which will then spread more of these. So we are hoping that these events that we become part of will bring those people who would want to learn, who would then, once learn, they would then go all other places and then will continue to proliferate this message of peace. Because without that, humanity has no meaning. If we don't have peace, we have no meaning. And I think God has created us not in vain, but for the purpose of having this peace. Without peace, there is no reason for humanity to exist.
I want to ask you, president of the organization, you walk in, I think you probably have another class here in a moment, you have a textbook with you, obviously a busy life, and then to become, you know, to be the president of a student organization just adds more to your life, so why do it? There are a lot of people who could just, you know, hit the couch instead.
Yeah, I agree with that. It is a lot of work, but I also have a lot of support. Like, I have, there's plenty of members who are willing to help in our organization, and then my family, of course, they're willing to help also. And the important thing is that this remain an organization, because if say, I didn't do this or I wasn't president, then, you know, who's to say someone else would be? And then we wouldn't even have the opportunity to educate people. And that's the important thing is, you know, just to make people aware of these issues and the things that we have sermons about, to educate them. And if we weren't here, then we won't know if someone else would be doing that. So I think it's important to get our voices out there and, you know, defend those who can't defend themselves.
I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I would imagine on March 7th, you would love for this to happen and see some faces you've never seen before. It's always wonderful to see friends and family, but...
That is true. We are trying to go out. We are advertising it in a big way. So a lot of people whom we have not met yet would come and would be able to learn for the first time from, as we say, from the horse's mouth, what Islam is all about. Because it's one thing to hear from, you know, your neighbor or from somebody who got hurt on some occasion by someone who didn't do him justice, or hearing it from the people who are the protagonists, you know, who support what they are doing, who know what they are doing. So I think that this is a chance that people can learn about Islam, and in particular about the Prophet's life and what his message was, if his message was truly of peace or of war. So I think this is a chance you can come. Even if you think otherwise, come out, because we'll have a question-answer session, no bars. The only bar is that you should be respectful and you know, and no debates. But other than that, you can ask any questions to the panel. We will have two scholars sitting there on the panel to answer any questions. And then afterwards, we will have some Middle Eastern food from Petra Cafe. So that will give us a chance to break bread while talking about these issues. And if you have any questions about why certain section of the society is behaving like this, you know, there are some people who have tried to hijack Islam. We want to hit them hard and take that back from them and tell people that it is not the terrorists who actually are the believers. It is the, you know, 1.499 billion people who are actually following the Prophet. What we want to do is we want to invite everybody. We will, you know, you will have you know, a feast of your lifetime, I tell you, because these are great scholars. We will always feel that we wish we had more time. So come one, come all.
Hamid Nassim, Khaled Al-Shalman, and Sophia Nassim are three of the organizers of the local Messenger of Peace seminar Thursday night inside Giffels Auditorium on the University of Arkansas campus.
I spoke with them inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF.
It is Tuesday, March 5th. 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Band concert time.
Yes.
This last night was a different set of UA bands. Tonight is the University of Arkansas Concert Band and the Wind Symphony. Mm-hmm. And they perform at 7:30 at the Walton Arts Center. It's a $5 ticket. Take your kids out and hear some music. Or if you're in the River Valley, tonight is part of the UAFS season of entertainment, 102 years of Broadway.
That's a lot.
No, I don't know why they picked 102 years, but they have Broadway stars doing music from some of the favorite shows like Phantom of the Opera. Mm-hmm. This starts at 7:30, and tickets start at $27 at 788-7300.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. If you were at the Walton Arts Center last night, you probably heard this piece being performed by the University of Arkansas Wind Symphony. Eric Cook's piece, Bolivar, also featured the talents of guest trombone artist Joe Alessi. Tonight, the UA Wind Ensemble will be joined by Alessi, who will perform a piece that was written for him by John Mackey, titled Harvest, Concerto for Trombone. In addition to being the principal trombone for the New York Philharmonic, Alessi is also on the faculty of the Juilliard School. Alessi is visiting Fayetteville this week to teach private lessons, conduct a master class, and perform in concert with UA students. Yesterday, Alessi stopped by KUAF and told me how he got his start as a trombonist.
Well, I come from a musical family, so it was pretty easy to get started. My father was a trumpet player, and my mother was a singer, and they both worked at the Met in New York City a long time ago. Anyway, so of course I wanted to do what my father did, and he played the trumpet, and I asked him. I think he probably put the trumpet in my hand at one point, or a cornet. It was a small trumpet. But then after 3 years of playing that, he thought that he could see that I was struggling in the high register. So, I was only 8 years old, so who knows if I would have ever figured it out. Nevertheless, he suggested the trombone to me. And I didn't really want to play it. I had no interest in playing the trombone. I wanted to do what he did, you know. But I tried it, and it shot right up to a high B flat, and that was the day I became a trombone player.
So you started learning this when you were eight, and then as you got older, did you play in school or in the local?
I played. We were lucky. We had fourth grade band.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and Ginny Jones was a teacher, and she was terrific. Taught us rhythms, and she was very strict with rhythm, and she didn't let us rush. And I remember I did probably the only arrangement that I ever did in my life was was when I was in fourth grade. I arranged the theme song from Bonanza for my fourth grade band, and. Anyway, so they had a great feeder system, you know. Mm-hmm. Then that would feed into the junior high band, mm-hmm. and that was very good. And then, you know, our high school had four bands, and I was in the wind ensemble, and we had a great jazz band. And at that time, you know, music was flourishing. My father was teaching tons of trumpet students, so everybody came to him to study trumpet. So all the guys at school studied with my dad, and you know, it was kind of a cool. I made a lot of friends, mm-hmm. back, and then I still have a lot of friends back there in San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay, and you grew up and continued playing, and
oh yes, I kept growing up, and let's see, I started freelancing. In the Bay Area, I was a member of a brass quintet, mm-hmm. and this in high school, a professional group, and actually they would pick me up from my high school, the trumpet player, and I would get excused from school to do these young people's concerts.
Awesome.
And so that was something I started off doing, and then I I got a professional, a couple professional offers on, you know, on top of that. One was kind of odd, which was it was to play in a Hare Krishna parade.
Okay.
So, which was fine. I enjoyed that and everything, and you know, I got paid for it, and
always good.
But continuing from there, I auditioned for Curtis unsuccessfully, which was in Philadelphia. And matter of fact, the guy who got in that year is from here. It lives here in Fayetteville.
Really,
Mr. Camilos.
Okay.
And but at the same time, I took that audition. I auditioned for a real orchestral job in San Francisco. It's the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra, which had a very extensive season and still does. And so I won that job, and I did not go to school, college right away. I took that 1 year, and I, you know, made decent money and saved, put it away, and to save for college. And then the following year, I went off to Curtis, and I got in the next year. So it's, you know, it's been, it was a nice journey to where I am now. From Curtis, I went right into the Philadelphia Orchestra,
mm-hmm.
and played with some great players and a great orchestra. I mean, Eugene Ormandy was still around, so I actually got to work with him. And then I saw a job opening in the Montreal Symphony. So I went up there and played mm-hmm. for a year, and then right at the same time, the New York Philharmonic job came open, and I've been there for starting my 29th year.
Wow, and you've been their principal trombonist that whole time?
Yes.
So you play with the New York Philharmonic, you teach at Juilliard, and yet you still find time to go play as a guest artist, which is why you're here in town with the university.
Well, yes. The life of a trombonist in an orchestra is a supporting cast member. The best way to say that, you know, we end up providing chords and sort of a cushion or texture where other instruments get to play on top of that, solos, and really express themselves. You know, first oboe, first horn, first flute, first clarinet. They all have the great musical lines. Every once in a while, there's something for the trombone, you know, solo to play. So playing in the orchestra, as great as that is, I have to go outside and use wind band and other orchestras, maybe even jazz every once in a while. I'll do that, but to use that as a vehicle to, you know, to really concertize and as a soloist.
Is it fun for you to be able to play with different musicians every now and then?
Oh yes, yeah. I love part of being a musician is traveling and working your way into any situation that comes up. So, and also the camaraderie and meeting new friends. And I have people come up to me and says, oh, you know, I played in the wind ensemble in New Mexico when you recorded something, you know, 10 years ago. And they're now professionals, these students. So that's kind of neat, you know, to see that happen.
Well, you've made quite the name for yourself, so you're able to travel across the country and I guess even the world, because you said you just got in from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So why continue to teach? Why not just be a performer?
Teaching was a part of my family. My father was a great teacher, and his father was a music teacher also. So there's something about the way that my father taught me that he instilled, you know, good rhythm and you know, singing on the instrument. And I feel almost obligated to pass that along. Especially since he was so passionate about it. You know, he gave up a whole career in New York to teach, and he was very proud of that. So I think if, you know, eventually I will just teach. I probably, you know, I'll still play, but not, I think that the teaching part of it for me is I'm very passionate about that, and I love to help my students. And I love to see, you know, good results with my students, but and it gives me a great gratification.
Joe Alessi is the principal trombone for the New York Philharmonic, and I spoke to him yesterday inside Studio 123. Alessi will perform with the University of Arkansas Wind Ensemble tonight at the Walton Arts Center. The concert, which will also feature the UA Campus Band, begins at 7:30 and admission is $5. More information is available at waltonartscenter.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court. When she graduated from law school in 1952, she called at least 40 law firms.
And not one of them would give me an interview. I was a woman, and they said, we don't hire women.
Justice O'Connor has a new book called Out of Order. Join us.
Fresh Air tonight at 6 on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me is Teresa Maurer, who is Fayetteville Farmers Market Manager. And technically, Teresa, first of all, welcome back.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back.
Technically, we're still in winter. You look at the calendar and it says we've got two and a half weeks to go.
Right.
But we know here that that's kind of spring-ish.
Spring-ish. And, you know, as far as the market goes, this is the first winter where we didn't stop. We've actually kept the markets going out at the Botanical Garden.
Saturdays?
Saturdays from 10 to 2 in a big white tent just south of the Botanical Garden. And some people, believe it or not, still don't know where the Botanical Garden is. It's on Crossover Road.
You should go.
Yes.
If you haven't been there, you should go.
Yes. And the tent has made it very nice. We've had vendors and customers there when there's snow on the ground, when it's 20 degrees. Of course, we don't prefer that, but we are there. And we've made that commitment every single week from 10 till 2.
Well, let's talk about March because there's something that's happening that could really be of value to some folks, and that's every Saturday at the Fayetteville Farmers Market at the Botanical Gardens. Some folks will be eligible for double the amount they would spend.
Exactly. And this is specifically for our SNAP recipients, which are the folks who it used to be called food stamps.
Right.
Now it's an electronic benefit transfer. It's a card that's swiped. And essentially the way it works is that you bring that card. If you're eligible, you know who you are. Mm-hmm. Bring that card to market. And if you swipe it for $20, you will get back 20 wooden coins plus another 20 wooden coins for a total of 40. And these spend just like money with the vendors.
Right. It is in under that tent. It is currency.
It is currency. That's correct. For meat, for eggs, for produce, for breads that you take home with you, all of those things are eligible. And we've got a really nice diversity of things there right now.
So, again, if you or you know someone who is eligible with the SNAP, the EBT card, they have that, they can go in and what would usually be worth $20 will now be worth
40. Right. You'll get 40 wooden tokens, and we'll give them to you so you can carry them easily. You can spend them at that market or at other markets during March at the Botanical Garden. We're focused on that market in particular. It's not going to last for very long. This is a limited time offer. So if you are a SNAP recipient or know somebody who is, please come to one of the Saturday markets at the Botanical Garden from 10 till 2. We'll be operating that until the funds run out. It's a $20 limit, so you can swipe for 20 and we'll give you 20 more, but double is great, and you can hold on to some of those and spend them later in March if you wish.
So that's every Saturday in March at the Fayetteville Farmers Market at the Botanical Garden.
Exactly, from 10 until 2.
Thanks, Teresa.
Thank you.
The Everly Brothers are one of the most beloved and most commercially successful duos in pop music history. As Ozarks at Large's Katie Henriksen noticed, their music is receiving attention from a new generation of musicians.
The Everly Brothers, Don and Phil, made close two-part harmonies their signature. They infused early rock and roll with the best elements of country and pop and are among the first generation of rock and roll superstars. They inspired countless musicians, including Simon and Garfunkel, Graham Parsons, Alison Krauss, and Jack White. Here's their own take on Omaha, which they wrote in 1969 but did not record until 1977 with the new album.
In one too brief minute, My mind saw it all, the time and the place, 12 o'clock noon, Omaha.
There's now a 21st century take on the Everly Brothers from one Bonnie Prince Billy, given name Will Oldham, and Don McCarthy. The new album is called What the Brothers Sang, just out on Drag City. Here's their take on Omaha.
In one too brief minute, my mind saw it all, the time and the place, 12 o'clock noon. Oh, oh,
Bonnie Prince Billy and Don McCarthy are no strangers as far as duets are concerned. In fact, they released a quintessential 21st century album of duets in Bonnie Prince Billy's 2006 album, The Letting Go.
And I called you back to a place beside me.
Original harmonies of Bonnie Prince Billy and Don McCarthy are haunting and set further apart from anything that is in the Everly Brothers tribute. Bonnie Prince Billy and Don McCarthy both grew up in the 70s and heard many Everly Brothers songs on the radio. Now, Wake Up Little Susie and Bye Bye Love, perhaps the Everly Brothers' largest hits, don't appear here, but Devoted does, as does So Sad to Watch Good Love Go Bad, which was immortalized by the grand duo of the 1970s, Emmylou Harris and Graham Parsons. Not all of the songs on What the Brothers Sang are actually written by the Everly Brothers. Poems, Prayers, and Promises is one of my favorite tracks, and of course that's a John Denver song from 1971. The Everly Brothers did, however, record the song.
I've been lately thinking about my lifetime, all the things I've done, how it's been, and I can't help believing in my own mind, no, I'm gonna hate to see it end. I've seen a lot of sunshine, slept out in the rain, spent a night or two on. I've known my lady's pleasures, had myself some friends, spent a time or two in my own home.
Picking up just where the Everly Brothers left off, here is Don McCarthy and Bonnie Prince Billy in Poems, Prayers, and Promises.
I have to say it now, it's been a good life all in all. It's really fine to have a chance to hang around. Lie there by the fire and watch the evening tire, while all my friends and my old foil sit and pass the pipe around and talk of poems and prayers and promises and things that we believe in.
How sweet it is to love someone, how right it is to care. How long it's been since yesterday, and what about tomorrow? What about our dreams and all the memories we share?
While paying tribute to the Everly Brothers and that great American songbook, Bonnie Prince Billy and Don McCarthy update the sounds for a whole new set of listeners. The album was recorded and mixed in Nashville by David Ferguson. The cast of well-sessioned musician friends in the studio with them is too large to list, although it includes longtime collaborator Matt Sweeney. This is a smooth studio production, but that doesn't mean that it isn't personal. This is a documentation of that special bond of friendship and love created when musicians bond over amazing music. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Illinois River Watershed Partnership and volunteers will plant 4,000 tree seedlings along area stream banks to create riparian buffers that help preserve and protect water quality in northwest Arkansas. More information about the riparian project is available online at irwp.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Let's see. We have four tickets to give away. Four pairs of tickets to the Masterworks 3 concert Saturday night.
Mm-hmm. By Sona.
By Sona, Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, featuring this concert features Verdi's Requiem. Huge, big. So four winners. And we're going to ask a question. If you know the answer, even if you don't know and you want to guess, you can send your email to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. That's where you send your answer, mm-hmm. ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
And you'll have until tomorrow to answer, so if you don't know, you can look it up.
That's right. If you want to tell me that you knew without looking up, want to brag on yourself, go ahead and do that.
Go for it.
And please give us your full name.
Yes.
Not just your email handle. So yeah. We know when we give your names for will call, what to call you.
Yes.
Okay, 67 years ago today, Winston Churchill delivered his famous Iron Curtain speech. It took place not that far from here. Where? Town and state. That's all.
See, I didn't know that until I saw that this morning. I was surprised that it was close.
Yeah, relatively close.
Relatively close.
Yes, driving distance, easily, within a day from here. So, 67 years ago today, when Winston Churchill gave his Iron Curtain speech, coined the term Iron Curtain, it was in what town in what state? ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Rye Hill.
Rye Hill. Where is Rye Hill?
Just south of Fort Smith.
Huh.
Yep.
Okay. Let's see. You will be with Christina Thomas tomorrow.
I will.
For a brand new edition.
Because you're leaving again.
I am. I'm now headed to Georgia, just outside Atlanta. We'll be doing the play-by-play of the Arkansas women's basketball team in the SEC tournament.
Well, good luck to them.
Yes, they play Thursday at noon. First, they play Florida. Should they beat Florida Thursday, they will play Tennessee, the number one seed in the SEC tournament, on Friday at noon.
Okay.
All right.
Again, good luck to them.
Yes. And then I'll be back next week to stay.
Sure, sure.
you don't believe that?
It's whatever.
Okay. Thanks again to everyone else on staff for making it possible for me to go do these side jobs.
Of course.
I appreciate it. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. It's been a while since I've done this. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
As I mentioned, Antoinette and Christina, together with you tomorrow. Please have a great Tuesday.